Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
The next speaker I'm really excited is James Peacock from the Anne Boleyn Society. So I got this biography off of your LinkedIn profile. And so since 2014, you have led the Anne Boleyn Society, which is an online community with over 20,000 followers. And it exists to celebrate the life and legacy of Queen Anne Boleyn and promote her influence on the shaping of British history, as that society aims to discuss and debate the life and times of both Anne while taking into account the period in which she lived. So I'm really interested to start with, how did you get into Anne Boleyn? How did this come about for you?
Oh gosh, that, do you know what, that, it started when I was very, very young. My interest in history kind of grew as a young child. I remember visiting certain locations like the Tower of London, Hever Castle and stuff. And I just found that the Tudor period in general, I found fascinating. Mm. But there was something in particular about Anne Boleyn that I always found so intriguing. And I was quite young when I watched the film Anne of a Thousand Days, and that just tipped the interest for me. That was just the big start for me. I just absolutely, from then on, had this real interest in this woman who came across so strong, so intelligent, so determined, and so passionate, and had this incredible story about her. But also just kind of, and I could tell from quite a young age reading books that she was judged so differently depending on who was writing the book or something. And it was just made me more and more intrigued about her. You know, there were some parts that you'd read that, or would find out that she wasn't, she didn't always come across as the easiest person, but other parts you'd read that she came across very much like a very kind and generous person. And that is one of the things that drew me to her, and has kind of been the interest ever since, really. And what I find still fascinating about her is because she comes across as human. You know, so many characters you read about in history, they come across quite one-dimensional, but with her, she comes across a lot more real. And I think that to me is where the interest has always been.
Mm, yeah, and it's interesting because you talk about the people either love her or hard to go middle of the road with Anne. One of the articles that I saw that you had written was like bitch Anne versus like thing. And I wonder, like, what? Tell me about what your opinion of that is.
I think, to be honest, I can imagine from her perspective, you know, trying to put yourself into their, I think it's always important, as you probably do yourself when you're reading about these people, you kind of put yourself into their perspective and think, okay, well, how would they have felt? How, you know, what must they have thought of this, and how frustrating this sort of thing must have been? And I think for Anne, she comes across as someone who shows her emotions, you know, someone who, some people could say someone who had a very loose tongue at times, but you can tell when she had pretty much, you know, like situations like with her stepdaughter Mary, for example, that was not an easy relationship. And you can tell that when she would try and reach out to Mary, and Mary understandably would knock her back because, you know, she obviously did not see Anne Boleyn as the queen. She was very much siding with her mother, and you can understand how for Anne that would be, you know, she wouldn't she couldn't control her emotions on that part. And that's what I think is so interesting about her. So you get this side that she doesn't always come across particularly easy and quite temperamental at times, but then you get this side to her where you hear stories about her charity and her generosity and how she looked after certain people who were exiles from abroad, who were interested in the Reformation, her interest in the poor, her interest in, you know, charity in general, which is just so, it's so interesting. And I think, you know, no one is a saint, no matter what, and I don't believe in saints, and I think that's one of the reasons why I like Anne, is because you, when you read about her, you really do get this sense that she was a real person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was almost human, huh?
Yes, exactly.
Go figure.
I know.
You know, it's interesting because sometimes people want to lump her into, or want to call her a feminist, and I always kind of hesitate to put these kind of modern concepts on people that wouldn't have had that kind of vocabulary and wouldn't have had those kind of thoughts. What do you think about her in terms of like a feminist or not?
I can see why people today look at her as a role model for feminists or female leadership. It's similar to her daughter, Elizabeth, and to an extent as well, Mary the First, mm-hmm. as well. But I am, like you said, I'm very hesitant to kind of put that sort of, give her that title, because that wasn't a title that existed in her time. And mm-hmm. I think I can see why people feel that she is ahead of her time in some ways, but I think she's very much of her time. And I think she's the product of this education and experience she'd had out on the continent at the courts of like Margaret of Austria and then at the court of France, when she'd been surrounded by these strong, influential women. And of course, then becoming queen and being crowned almost like a monarch rather than a consort. And I think really she's very much of her time, and she's working within the, you know, the boundaries of her time, really. Yeah.
It's interesting. I want to talk about that early educational experience, and also ties in with this summit, because one of the other speakers is Danielle, the 5-minute medievalist, talking about Christine Pizan, who would have, perhaps her writings would have been at the court of Margaret of Austria, and her writings are again something people try to say is feminist or not, or, you know, there's the debate over her. And I guess I want to ask you about this kind of early education that Anne had at the court of Margaret of Austria, and surrounded by these powerful queens of the continent. And I, can you just talk to me a little bit about her early role models in that respect?
Yeah, well, I feel quite strongly that was her big impact, really. I mean, going to the court of Margaret of Austria, this woman who had been married a few times, had turned down suitors and was ruling as regent for her, you know, and then you go to, then Anne goes to France, and obviously she's at the court of France, and you've got Marguerite of Angoulême and Louise of Savoy. So you've got these powerful figures who are very much involved in politics and the governments of these countries. And even then, when she comes back to England, you've got Catherine of Aragon, who, it was a number of years before that, but before Anne came back, but she was ruling as regent whilst Henry was away. So you've got, so she's got these influences to go on for herself. And I think that would have had such a strong, obviously we don't know what conversations would have taken place between her and these women and everything, but you can't deny that they must have had a huge impact on her and who she became.
Yeah. And this was such an interesting period in terms of education for women in general. It seems like there was this kind of height of learning for women during this period. And even you talk about with Catherine of Aragon and the way she coordinated her daughter's education. And it was this broad humanistic thing that later on you don't see under the Stuart kings, and earlier you don't see. And she was of age right during the height of that, and a lot of value on that. What kind of stuff do you think she was reading at these places, and how do you think, like, I think about the religious texts too that she had access to.
Yeah.
What kind of, tell me about, like, what kind of books and authors, can you tell me anything about what she would have been, what her influences would have been like that?
Well, it's obvious that her love of manuscripts and, you know, courtly love and things would have started at these courts, for example. And she must have read works of Christina and others. I'm stumbling a bit.
It's fine. I just kind of threw that out there. But even like the early Reformation works that wouldn't have made it to England yet, she would have had access to that.
Yeah.
And she would have probably been able to read it even as a woman because she was with these powerful women, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it could have been when she first came across Tyndall and places like that. And, it's tempting to imagine her at like one of the gatherings of Marguerite of Angoulême and in the discussions there. And with her sharp intellect, which she had, it just feels so wrong for her to think her not being part of that. Obviously, you know, she was a lady in waiting, and, you know, Margaret of Angoulême is the sister of the King of France. But you kind of think, and especially from like letters from one time that Anne is queen and how she wished she'd meet Marguerite again and stuff, there must have been some relationship. So she must have been involved and read the exact works that would have been in the library of Marguerite, and even earlier, Margaret of Austria. I mean, this seems to be when she really came up. This was like her coming of age period. And it just feels that, you know, she must have read all the like stuff that hadn't made it over to England. I mean, because we know that when she came back to England and when she, first appeared at court, she was completely different to all the other English ladies. She stood out for her dress sense, her intellect, her, you know, her, I'm struggling to find the word now, but her, you know,
je ne sais quoi.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That seems to be her, you know, she, so yeah, that is just, it's a fascinating time, really. Yeah.
So what, as you research Anne, what has been your biggest kind of eye-opening discovery, or kind of something that you had maybe believed about her that then when you found out something different surprised you? Or tell me a little bit about like how your relationship to her evolved. And
I think for me what I'm still very much learning more now, one of my big interests is her role in the Reformation. And it's something I'm starting to delve deeper into now because I really want to sort of understand that a bit more and stuff, and the Reformation in itself. And I think that in particular, her, the more you read about it and you read about her connections to people like Cranmer and other bishops and everything who were very big figures in the Reformation, how they were very much part of her support faction. And then you hear about stories, like one of my favourites is the story of Hales Abbey, while she and Henry were staying at Sudley Castle. And she, it was her really who investigated, who initiated the investigation into the supposed holy relic that was there. And, you know, so stuff like that, which never really gets touched on, never gets mentioned. And it's such a shame because I think that's her role in that is so underplayed.
Yeah. And then also once the Reformation had been set in motion, almost the relationship with Cromwell falling apart because of going too far in a sense, like with dissolving all of the monasteries.
Yep. Yeah, indeed. And I think that's another thing. People, similar to the feminist title, people often label her very quickly as a Protestant. But back then, the lines between Catholic and Protestant were not as clear and distinct as they would later become. Who knows what would have happened had she lived another 10, 20 years. But that's another thing. I'm slightly hesitant, you know, when people start giving her that title, because obviously, you know, we have to look at that. I think more of an evangelical as stuff is probably the better way to describe her. And I think, you know, that's an interesting one, is her religion and, well, the religion of the time, really. Reformation was still in its very early stages.
Yeah, definitely. It's like they didn't have the understanding of Protestant Catholic. It was like transubstantiation and the miracle of the Mass and and like, where do you fall on those lines? But it wasn't necessarily, I'm a Protestant. Yeah, interesting. She definitely had such a role with that, though. It was almost like this perfect storm, wasn't it, with her?
It's a story you couldn't really make up, really. I mean, here's this girl who's not a princess by birth. She goes off to the courts of Europe. She comes back to England. A few years later, the king catches the eye of the king, and he decides he wants her as a mistress, but then he wants to marry her, and there's this whole turbulent period. And then at the end, you've got the execution, which is a bit like, someone once described it as like the story of Arthur and Guinevere, but unlike the Guinevere story where she saves at the last minute and is executed, and it's that incredible kind of, well, how did it all change so quickly? But then about 20 years after that, you've got the story of her daughter coming to the throne and very much defining female monarchs forever, and has in many respects, and as many people say, she was the most successful of all Henry's children. And you know that, which just, it's the irony of it all. It's not the son that he wanted, it's the daughter he had with Anne Boleyn that ended up being one of the most successful monarchs in British history. And it's all part of that story that pieces together, which it's almost like something that I don't think, if you were writing a fictional drama, you couldn't even make that sort of stuff up, really. It's just incredible.
So going back to the girl, and she's coming home and catching the attention of the king, there's a lot of debate around how her family and her father, and did they push her into this role, or was she scheming at it? What do you think about, there's even so much people have said, like, oh, she was pimped out, and you know, the sisters and stuff like that. And I'm curious what your opinion is about that, and just kind of talking a little bit about how you think she felt about Henry, and especially in those early stages.
I really do feel sorry for Anne's father. I think he gets an even worse deal than Anne, really. And I don't think it's fair when people say that he pimped her out. Thomas Boleyn was already a very successful courtier. He was already riding high at court in favour of the king. So I don't see why he would want two of his daughters become mistresses. There's even a report from Chapuys, which I always love to mention, which kind of hints that he wasn't actually as entire and never had come out in favour of this whole great matter and the marriage between Anne and Henry, or the relationship, I should say, really, between Anne and Henry in the beginning. And I think, because, you know, you've got this long period that the great matter went on for, and I think from his perspective, there was always that worry of, well, is it actually going to happen? Because there were so many stumbling blocks along the way. And if it didn't happen and the relationship fell apart, he would have had two daughters who would have been the discarded mistresses of the king. And that would not have gone down well for him at all. And by that stage as well, his daughter Anne would have been, you know, beyond the age of the marriage market and everything. She would have been considered old in the Tudor time, so, and he couldn't have then arranged probably a good marriage for her. So I do feel quite strongly that I don't agree with the famous story that he pimped his daughters really out at all. But it's such an intriguing one, the whole about Anne coming back, because we know obviously she had marriage contracts and everything, which then fell apart. And I certainly think in the early days, probably, you know, that she no doubt would have enjoyed the attention of anybody, you know, anyone would enjoy the attention, especially of a king. And I know that there's often, this is where another debate with Anne comes in, because like you said, people either see her as the scheming who sets out to become queen, or they see her as, you know, this harassed victim by Henry. I think probably it's somewhere in the middle on that one. I think, you know, I don't think she, I think, you know, she certainly wouldn't have wanted to become a mistress like her sister. We know she turned that down. I don't think she would have expected, though, anyone would have expected the king to marry. And I know people often kind of put the words into her mouth a little bit that, you know, she then set out to say to him, well, if you make me your wife instead. In those days, obviously, you know, the hierarchy and everything, you've got God and the king, and everyone saw the king as God's anointed and everything, you know, God's representative on earth. And I think, you know, I kind of feel that that's bordering into the feminist title that people think of today a little bit. It's almost like, say, would she have been that daring really to speak to a king like that? I think, you know, possibly she could have maybe lost her head a bit sooner or something had she done. But equally, I think when the crown was offered, you know, who is going to turn that down? It's an incredible advancement for herself, for her family. And I think by that stage, you know, you can't turn down an offer like that. It should be, yeah.
Yeah. So do you think she had any kind of affection for him, or like, do you think she was ever in love with him, or was it more like pragmatic?
It's so frustrating that we don't really have any of her letters, and they all seem, the replies to Henry must have been destroyed or lost or something. I think she must have had some affection for him. There certainly is some evidence that later on, that as their relationship was progressing as well, that there was some affection returned from her to him. And so I think there must have been some affection there in that relationship. Certainly they worked so closely together, he treated her as an equal, and they were constantly in each other's company. So I think there must, you know, I don't feel that it was just from her point of view, it was all the greed and the power. For him, I don't think it was the obsession always either. I think, you know, he generally seems to, certainly in the early days, you know, he generally seemed to appreciate her input. And I think, you know, they obviously, it's hard because everyone, you know, you always judge history, people do judge history backwards, but really they were, when you think that, they were a great match for each other.
Yeah, definitely, that on a personal level at least. And then that kind of gets me and segues nicely into her downfall. Like, obviously you can say the really obvious part, she had a daughter and then she miscarried and there was that whole stuff, and then the political landscape changing. But where do you, and then people say about, well, her personality was great as a mistress but not as a wife, and there's a lot of different elements that go into it. But how do you get in 3 years from marriage and coronation, how do you do that?
Incredible. And I think that is the reason why her story is so fascinating, and why people just, I don't think there'll ever be a time when her story is not being constantly printed in biographies or fiction books or TV dramas or theatre plays and stuff, because I think everyone wants to put forward their own opinion and research it for themselves. And I think, I mean, like you said, it's so fascinating. It is just so bizarre. And the whole change of the mentality in that, you know, people, there's all sorts of theories of, was it the fact that she couldn't have a son and there have been miscarriages? Was it the fact that Henry then had this accident and he wasn't of the right frame of mind afterwards? Was this plot that was put against her just so convincing, and it was seen as a chance to really get her out of the way had she become dangerous? I mean, I do feel that one thing I feel quite strongly of is, it's very popular in like the world in fiction, I've noticed, really, for the relationship start going wrong after she gave birth to a daughter and not the son that was so promised and so hoped for. But we know from later records, particularly around like the Royal Progress of 1535, that they were very much, it seemed like it had gone back to the early days again. They were very much in love. They were constantly together. And even reports from Chapuis and stuff were stating that, you know, yes, they would argue, but then they would passionately make up afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it's this temperamental relationship, but it seems to have gone fairly well right up until the last few months, if anything, and yeah, who knows really what the actual answer is as to why it all goes wrong. But I kind of think, and maybe I'm sitting on the fence here a little bit, but I kind of think it was this combination of all these things going on, her miscarriage, Henry's accidents, and then of course the case put against her, her falling out with Cromwell. It all must have come together. I think it's too easy to have one answer. I think there's just, when you look at the evidence, it just seems like it must have been all these things coming together that caused it.
Can you tell me a little bit about her relationship with Cromwell and how that evolved and devolved or fell apart?
I always feel that Anne and Cromwell, looking at the evidence, and well, from what I've researched into and seen, they both come across very similar. Mm-hmm. They both come across as people who stand out a bit more from the crowd at court. Both very sharp intellectual, both slightly seem a bit wary of other people and having their own sorts of, you know, kind of gay, their own kind of thoughts, and not, you know, both wanting to be that position of authority and with the king. And I think it seems, certainly in the early days, they could work very well together. But I do think it seems to have disintegrated because of both of their ambitions obviously came to clash. It seems that they were just too similar. And I think it seems to come from then that in the end, only one of them could survive. There was only room for one of them. And Cromwell seems to have got in there first, it seems.
Yeah. So can you talk to me then a little bit about the history of how she has been portrayed? I know you've written and talked a bit about her portrayal in media, and if you can talk a little bit about kind of how that also has evolved and changed. Because I feel like 100 years ago the portrayal of her was different than it is today.
Very much, it's and has evolved with the changing attitudes of times. And certainly after her execution, you have this period of time where it's almost like she's erased, or she's forgotten about, or if she is mentioned, particularly in Mary's reign, it's not in a positive light. And then of course we've got Elizabeth coming to the throne and her memory is restored. And that she becomes a lot more celebrated. She's the mother of the Queen. And that's kind of when she suddenly gets transformed into this Protestant hero, the Protestant martyr. And then over time, you've got this, again, this changing, evolving, you know, like the Victorians. She becomes this romantic victim, you know, the lady in the tower, as it were, and everything. And there's that romantic side to the story that comes out. And then, of course, you go on later to like the 1960s and Anne of a Thousand Days. And in the feminist craze, you can tell that that very much influences the film. You know, Genevieve Bujold's portrayal is phenomenal, but you can tell it is very much influenced by the feminist ideas at the time. And of course, then it's involved again to slightly, you know, like the Mean Girls and stuff portrayal, and you know, the other Boleyn girl and everything like that. And you know, she is definitely someone who has, with the changing attitudes of time, or what's the view at the time towards women, it seems that she's very much, it has a big influence on how she is portrayed in novels, or you know, in the media basically, really. Yeah,
she's almost like a weather vane or something.
Very large, yeah.
So what do you think is, like, why does Anne deserve her own society? Why is she worth studying? Why is her story still lingering with us? Why does she have her own society?
Well, the idea really came about for me around the time of the whole announcement that the bones that were found in the car park in Leicester were Richard III. And a shout out here to Sarah Morris, who's co-authored the book In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn and is currently running the Tudor Travel Guide. I remember on a patient she was running at the time, she happened to mention, well, why doesn't Anne Boleyn have a society? She would have loads of members. And it kind of made me think, actually, yeah, I think she would. She would. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, and at the time, I thought, there's no way I could set it up. I'd have to work with someone else. And I thought about it. And in the end, I remember contacting her, and she was ever so supportive and gave wonderful ideas and everything. And it kind of just evolved from there. And then I've decided, you know what, I will set it up and just see how it goes. And it's taken off. And I think so I'm so pleased that that kind of happened, really. So that's how it kind of came about. And I think that Anne certainly deserves her society, because her own society, because similar to Richard III, you've got these two completely different viewpoints about her. And I do feel she is misunderstood and misrepresented at times. And I think it's a chance to debate and discuss her life, but also celebrate her role and the fact that she did have this huge impact on history. And I know some people will think that I'm romanticizing her a little bit there by doing that, and maybe I am, but I do very much believe she had a huge role in history. And there's so much debate about her, and that should continue. Debates about everyone should continue, as it does. But there's not much celebrating of all that goes on. And it's what is not looked at, what is completely ignored, is what role she had in history, the impact. And that is something that I'm very passionate about bringing out a bit more and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So other than the English church and breaking away from the Pope and having her daughter and all of that minor stuff, what is her impact on British history?
I think she was such an intelligent woman, and she was a huge interest and promoter of the arts and, you know, manuscripts and everything, and being involved in that stuff, in the politics side of things. And, you know, that's not to say that we hadn't had women and queens before that had done that, but I think she certainly helped set that standard at the time, certainly for consorts. And I think that's not looked at often, is the fact that she kind of helped. I do feel that she had a role in helping adapt that role of the role of the consort. So they weren't just merely a sidekick to have babies and produce the heirs and everything. That I feel is something she should be celebrated for more, and something that should be noted more.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've often heard like Catherine of Aragon described as the sort of last medieval queen, as it were, and Anne Boleyn like the first more modern queen. Yeah. And I don't know that necessarily always fits, because you've got like Eleanor of Aquitaine and people like that, which is this idea of the woman as the child bearer, and that's her son, and she's the peacemaker and the child bearer, and Anne certainly burst through that
definitely. And like you said, there had been queen consorts before that certainly weren't just the peacemaker or the childbearer. Like you said, Eleanor of Aquitaine, Margaret of Anjou, and Isabella of France, you know, there were these incredible women, and she I think helped. She was part of you can't not include her in that set of these incredibly intelligent women who had a role in, not necessarily in promoting women's interests at the time, because that wasn't something of the time, but unknowingly I think it very much seems to have it helps adapt that, and helps to, you know, which is why people nowadays look back on that and see that as a inspiration for what they can continue today and what has continued since, really.
Yeah, that's, and she's kind of like the high point. And with Elizabeth, it really, after her, it doesn't really get much better than that.
It doesn't. And like you said, because I mean, her daughter obviously goes on to become queen. And I always remember this great quote from Tracy Borman, was that Elizabeth was able to be the queen that her mother wasn't able to be. She was able to take on, she seems to have had the best of both sides from both her parents. Obviously she said she very much modeled herself on her father, which is which was completely the right thing to do. Her father was the king and he was respected. So to do that was just genius, really. But she seems to have taken on the best of both of her parents and adapted that and to become such a successful monarch in her own right. It's incredible. And again, she is another figure who, you know, you look to as this incredible monarch, and again, set the standard for female monarchs after that, really.
Yeah, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, that's an awesome high note to leave it. Where can people find out more about you and your work and just get more involved with the Anne Boleyn Society and with you?
So the Anne Boleyn Society is on Facebook. That is where most of the discussions and everything can take place from there, and people can message me at any time through there. I'm also on Twitter, and that is, my username is @society_Anne, and the same on Instagram, same username on that, and I'm contactable on all three of those platforms. It's where I post the most on. So mainly on Facebook and Instagram. More than Twitter, it seems. That's where I'm more, you're more likely to be able to contact me on those. But yeah, if anyone wishes to contact me, I'm more than happy. I regularly will post book recommendations, not necessarily just on Anne, on the period in general and stuff. And yeah, I'm always up for a discussion and debate and everything.
Awesome. So you've been so generous with your time, and I really have loved speaking with you. And I know this is probably going to get some big debates started when people watch this as well. So we'll have fun with that. But thank you so much for taking the time and for being so generous and for sharing so much about Anne with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's an absolute honor to be part of this. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.